Hey friends, this is Chris Jansen. Evil is the destruction of freedom. Welcome to the End Evil Podcast. Just wanted to draw your attention to a couple great things you can check out when you're done watching this show. Pop on over to Twitch and check out Brandon Spencer's 24/7 live stream coming at you with truth, freedom, natural law, all the time, every day. Also want to bring your attention to Mondays. You can check out my good friend Crypt Rick on Revolution Radio at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. And now, I have a great show for you. Thanks for joining me. Please stop on by to endevil.life and make a small donation or share something from the website. Subscribe to the channels and enjoy the show. Check out the chemtrails.
I'm in a cage. I'm in a prison. I'm in a mental prison, and a physical one at that, and definitely a spiritual one, whether that's recognized at a conscious level or not.
As I wake from my sleep, this situation's got me thinking, game, will that hurt the same? Get on, life is in extinction, evil creeps in your dreams, secret team calling me, and the villain in the in-betweens. Mind control for the teens, now they got you on your knees. I'm making my way through this often maze, but I'm dazed by mass confusion. All the images that they're using.
There's the rest, race to the tip of the top of the pyramid. The pyramid,
rising up our criminal
pyramid,
falling in, you know, to this low level of spiritual awareness, such that these methods can have any effect over us.
Hello, hello. Welcome, friends. This is the End Evil Podcast. My name is Chris Jansen, and evil is the destruction of freedom. And I'm here today live with you folks, and we're going to have some live chat today. I'm continuing a conversation about worldviews and belief systems. I think this is key and at the very core and root of the difference between a world of freedom and a world of slavery. Right now, the main reason that we are caught in a world of slavery is because most people don't recognize the condition we're in as slavery. Otherwise, I don't think that they would be letting that be. And I already did some discussion a little earlier yesterday and today on this, and I'm going to play a short 6-minute little conversation I put together to start this conversation off. And I'm going to invite anyone, any viewers that want to join me today on the live chat. I already have one good friend in the waiting room. And after this short little piece by myself, I'm going to open the conversation up for you folks to chime in and share your many more than 2 cents. Because if you have real sense, you're probably the type of person like myself that is looking for better solutions and wants to see an end to evil and is just tired of all the corruption. Sorry about the fans in the background. It's pretty hot over where I'm at, so there's going to be some background sound. I'll mute when I get a chance. But thanks for coming to the End Evil Podcast. Evil is the destruction of freedom. In about 6 minutes, I'll open the live chat and I'll be sharing that link in it. Look in the live chat in the comments, and you'll find that link. All right, here we go.
Weeks ago, it was called Realigned Worldviews. Well, the original episode was called Misaligned Worldviews. and I shared a list that I created about all the commonalities I could think of in worldviews and belief systems that wind up being destructive or are destructive right on their face. And I listed some of the attributes of these misaligned worldviews that I think keep people from being able to see common sense obvious, including myself, for many years. And I'm sure there's still things I could come to realize, but by understanding these worldview issues, I feel like I've got a lot of clarity in my life. And when I see things happening in the news or hear people talking about big things, I feel like I know really quickly where I stand on things and what's right and what's wrong. And you know, our An Evil podcast is always all about morality. Evil is the destruction of freedom. Freedom is the embodiment of love and care. It's offering new life, new creation, the ability to do good things that have never been done before, or to do as one pleases, as long as one's actions don't inhibit others' actions to live and must survive and go about their business. So that's basically the golden rule, right? Do unto others as you would have done unto them. And yet, blatantly, right in our average worldview, people think that it's okay for somebody to be in charge of the land, call themselves a president, a governor, or a mayor, or whatever, and start making decisions about your personal life, even down to, you know, what cards you carry in your wallet, and what speed you travel on the freeway, and what foods you put in your body, and what sort of health resources you choose to use, or what insurance you decide to use or not. You know, these people have completely ignored that code because they're saying, no, there is no fucking golden rule. There is no common sense. The only rules of right and wrong are the rules that I enforce with my iron fist, that those of us that have the power and money agree on, vote on, and enforce. Those are the only rules. Outside of that, if you want to study other rules, then that's some religion. That's Christianity. That's Catholicism. That's whatever. That's the average human point of view these days, it seems like. They really do think that there's no moral law, there's no common sense golden rule outside of their particular religion. Because, you know, I've heard a lot of Christians tell me that, you know, if you don't believe in the Bible, then you're going to hell, basically. And I don't know what they mean by believe in the Bible, but I mean, I think I know what they mean. But it doesn't make any sense in a practical sense to just believe in a whole book without, you know, especially a book like that that's so complicated that involves so many writers and history and changes and political influence. So, you know, the whole idea here is we had another episode with the One Great Work Warriors recently called Finding the Words, Definitions, Meanings, Finding Meaning, Clarity with Words. Finding Clarity with Words is what I called it, but we had a couple of titles we were playing with. But the point is that, you know, in order to be clear, we have to agree on certain things. And where we're at in the world right now is we're not agreeing on the most basic fundamental things at all. And that is evident because of the type of subtle slaveries that are being employed by governments. It's one of the most obvious and blatant ignorance on a mass scale of morality and of the moral law of the golden rule. Anything that tries to tread over top of that or ignore that is wrong. It is blatantly wrong. And I think a good simple example that doesn't involve death is parking tickets, especially in a downtown. You know, I've had a town or a city I grew up in. They started taking taxes out of my paycheck before I could vote in their fucked up system. So that's taxation without representation. And then those taxes were used to put in new parking meters in the downtown of where I lived. And then, you know, like one day I just stopped for 5 minutes, jumped out of my car, or less than 5 minutes to run in the store, come back out, and there was a guy trying to put a ticket on my window. So I'm getting extortion from the same town who bought those meters and who paid that parking attendant out of money that was stolen from my pocket before I had the right to even have a say in what was done with it, even in the minimalist sense. So, as I pointed out to people, voting does not give you options in terms of day-to-day life decisions. You know, no vote ever came about to allow me to say that I don't want there to be vaccines, or I don't want there to be mandatory closures of stores or mandatory mask wearing. You know, I didn't, as long as me and a lot of people never voted on that and never wanted that. I don't want, there's a lot of things I don't want that I would never vote for, that I would fight against tooth and nail if I had the opportunity. But, you know, it's not like you get a choice on most of these things. The voting is like, you're voting for one evil guy or one other evil guy. Neither guy has morality. They're both willing to use your money that was stolen from you to extort you and probably kill you if they had the chance and you disagreed with them. So where's the common sense morality? Where's the, you know, where's the common sense worldview? It doesn't exist. So let's begin the conversation. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Okay, so I'm going to have to turn my mic on so you can hear me. And looks like I have some awesome people that decided to join me tonight for the live chat. Bear with me, folks. There's some new format changes here on Restream, so it might do some funny things. But look, everything seems to be working as it should. Oh, yes, look at all these awesome, wonderful people I have to join me tonight. So I've talked quite enough. You just heard me going on and on. So I would love to hear from you, some of you folks. And thanks for joining me, good friends and truth seekers. What's up, Will?
What's up, gentlemen? Good seeing y'all. Thanks for having us back on, Chris.
Hey, good evening. I'm getting my my cherry popped on the show over here, first time.
Yeah, good to meet you, Zerlith. I heard a lot about you, good things only, and I'm glad you made it on the show. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I tune in periodically. I'm familiar with a bunch of you guys. Brandon, good to meet you for the first time.
Hey, how's it going?
Great.
What's up, Brandon and Marvin? This is Marvin from Join the Internet. He makes some great music, and he helped work with me on this document that's inspiring this session. So I'm just going to let you guys jump in, and looks like Jerry popped back in. What's up, Jerry? Hey. Yeah, anybody have any comments on the top? Or, you know, I should start. If anybody wanted to introduce themselves, feel free to take a minute and do that. Will, everybody knows Will. He's been here. If you've watched the End Evil podcast at all, willkeller.com. Zerlith, am I saying your name correctly?
Yeah, that works. Zerlath, or whatever. In honor of like ancient Italian ancestry, it's an Etruscan kind of mashup word I created for my avatar, if you will, my awesome self, right? Mm-hmm. So it's Zeri and Zelath. And I put them together, which basically means a free individual and cultural functionary. So I'm basically I'm an independent shaman is basically the idea.
Renaissance man.
Yeah. I've got my channel Zerlath Mortal. My history goes back to 2012. I was part of the original crew of people on Revolution Radio. Shout out Crypt Rick. I started off there under a different moniker of Steve Travesty. And then I became Zerlath after somebody convinced me that Travesty was kind of a cool sounding name, but it wasn't really bestowing much good upon you. So I switched it up to something I love 10 times more. But anyway, the most important thing is I've been doing this conspiracy thing for a very, very long time, and I've gone through many, many different thoughts, modalities, transformations, So I've been in the game for a hot minute. I've lost my interview that I originally had with Mark Passio many years ago. Steve Travesty has a Ghost in the Machine episode on Black Earth Productions channel when I was on Revolution Radio when I met Seth Gasboza. And so I operate with a shout out to Black Earth Productions, Temple of the White Dragon. That's me.
Great to meet you.
Thank you for that introduction. Go ahead, Marvin.
Chris, I just wanted to comment. I love the video before you bring the live chat on, because it kind of feels like, have you guys ever been to Universal Studios and like before those immersive ride starts, they put like a little framing video? It just kind of reminded me of that. So I just thought that's a cool way to bring people in. So just wanted to mention that.
Hey, actually, we got a comment from Leslie. She was asking if we could read the realigned document. You want to help me with that, Marvin?
Yeah, I was thinking, Chris, maybe it would be good if you want to just share the story of how the realigned worldviews came out. I know that you did the episode about the misaligned worldviews and you walked through all of that. This is all, of course, because we're all very interested and focused on getting through to the masses. And so just that framework helps. But you want to just share how we kind of did the inverse of each misaligned worldview?
Yeah, okay. Well, to begin with, the misaligned worldviews was a happy accident or a interesting synchronicity. I was doing some organization, and I came across something I'd written a long time ago, and it happened to align with the misaligned worldviews and belief systems I was thinking about at the time. And it was actually back when I was doing some work on a presentation where I was looking at the similarities between religions and governments. Well, governments are religions, but most people don't recognize that. So I was trying to find a lot of the similarities. And in that process, I came up with this whole list of worldview and belief system problems, right? And so I published that and did a show like this to bring on some other people and get their point of view. And then Marvin took that in the following day or two, and he said, hey, why don't we make like a positive version and kind of like invert it into what should people do instead of what should people not do? And I was like, dude, that's a good idea, you know, that's positive, you know, and that kind of fits in with Marvin's always talking about easing people in. So yeah, and then we shared a Google document together, which I have shared in the live chat if anyone wants to check it out. And I'll repost it again soon. And Marvin made a whole list of the positive inversion, and then I made some changes the way I liked it a little better, and then we got to where we are now. So thanks for the collaborative assistance there. And really, you know, like people like Will and Brandon and Jerry that I talk to on a weekly basis are always contributing to all the good thoughts I have. So thank you guys for that too.
It was fun.
Quick question. Why did you choose the word inversion?
So from my end, I like the word inversion because that's the word that Satanists use. So if they're going to use these terminologies and these strategies, I want, like, this is my opinion, Chris, I don't know how you would look at it, but I want to use the same strategies that they will and invert them, because in our world, in the day-to-day, we're going to see them advertising. So I want to, on my end, do the same thing, but do the inverse of it.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, that as best I could see, that word basically means reversing something. So I thought, well, that makes sense. Inversion is taking something, either turning it inside out or outside in. And that seemed to be appropriate to me. Wait, does that strike you as strange, Brandon? I'm curious why that.
Yeah, because it means to corrupt. And when you put positive in front of it, it kind of almost turns in almost like an oxymoron. But, you know, that's just me. Because if something's positive and then you go the opposite direction, then you would be going negative. And that's the only reason why I had asked that. But,
that's,
you know, I mean, you know, it's just by bringing more clarity. And, you know, we talked about, you know, words and the definition and the meanings, and And I just wanted to bring that up. But, I mean, you know, I understand, you know, what you were saying. And, yeah.
Aesthetically, you know, I'm an artist, so I like to be provocative. I like to kind of challenge. So the idea of corrupting negative sounds interesting, actually.
yeah.
So, okay. Yeah, interesting.
And I like the way you put it as far as, you know, trying to, you know, go the opposite direction and kind of use the same, you know, means. But I just wanted to, you know, bring that up because, you know, how the definitions and clarity always brings more more light to the subject. So,
yes.
I'll jump in on there because And I don't mind wordplay, and you know, something that kind of hooks someone. That's kind of cool. But when Brandon brought it up, I thought of another word that's similar: reversion. That word means bringing it back to its original state. So that would be the opposite of inversion. Just another kind of wordplay, returning to original state or position or condition.
I think what I enjoyed about the idea, like, because, you know, you're talking about the double negative effect, right? Because we're sitting in, I think all of us have kind of, like, because of our love for being more in alignment with natural law and getting things back in alignment, right? We're sitting in this theater of the absurd through the twists and the inversions that already are. So it's kind of a play on the word, because if something's already inverted, it's like if you invert it again, kind of like mathematically, it flips it back, and it's like psychic judo. Right. Yep. Because you're using the enemy's power against them, because, oh, you've turned my six into a nine. Oh, look at that. I can flip it back into a six again. F you. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, it was kind of cool for me because, you know, I started it off with misaligned worldviews, and that often this whole thing kind of points to the perspective of one of the troubles I see with trying to teach natural law, or trying to teach and come to better understand myself, morality, is that most of the world is just looking at this whole, you know, subject matter from such a vastly different perspective. It's easy for me to get critical, especially over time. You know, we've all watched Mark Passio and how frustrating, you know, it must be to try to talk to people about something that seems really obvious and have them continually not understand what you're saying. So I do find myself often becoming somewhat critical of those out there in the world that are completely oblivious to these things. And sometimes I speak a little bit more pessimistically or in a negative manner than I would like to, knowing that that doesn't always help the people that I'm trying to speak towards. You know, all that to say, when you said, hey, let me rewrite it as realigned, that to me seemed like, oh, why didn't I think of that first? You know, why did I think of it in the more negative sense? But right. Not to say one's better than the other, but, you know.
Two sides of the same coin. Well, what do you think, Chris? Do you think a good approach to dive in is to maybe just read one and then the opposite? Or how would you?
That's a great idea. Let's start with the first one. I'll read misaligned and then you read realigned.
Okay, cool.
The misaligned worldview for number one was repetitive ritualistic habits done automatically, regardless of other factors or extenuating circumstances.
And then the realigned version is engaging in rituals and habits mindfully, considering their relevance and meaning in the present moment, goals, etc. Maintaining awareness that any ritual or habit has the potential to harm individuals, groups, or nature, being sure to respect the inherent danger when mindfulness is not employed. And, you know, rituals to me are as benign as, you know, brushing your teeth in the morning or having breakfast and things like that. So I think any ritual or habit can quickly become harmful if we're not mindful.
Maybe I'll put you a little bit on the spot on this one, Jerry. Because we've talked, I know you and I have talked somewhat about rituals and habits and good ones that we want to do more of, and bad ones, you know, and that's something that comes up a lot in autonomy as well. What do you think about that topic, Jerry?
Thanks for asking. I apologize if I'm a little bit laggy. I don't know. But if it gets too bad, let me know. What I think about it, what came to mind was like, what bad habits do I engage in? Possibly doing something while I should be doing something else. So that's what came to mind.
Yeah, like valuing your time, prioritizing it for...
Yeah, I mean, an example is, like, I go to the gym every morning. So if I decide to spend an extra hour there while I should be working, then I'm not really aligned to my goals. I'm just sort of, I guess, wasting time. So it's like a balance is needed.
Like many people of my generation, I was in a bad case that was instilled in me in early childhood of, you know, just like the TV shows, the junk food and everything like that. And it becomes that, like, that excitement of getting done with what the world wants you to do so you can get to what you want to do and dive into all your pleasure centers of the brain, entertaining yourself with the video games and the cartoons and the everything else. I got hit really hard with it, put me into a serious amount of detriments, you know, which my astrology chart wasn't helping either. But of course, who knew back in the 80s, right? So, yeah, in order for me to change, you know, you had to cut out bad habits, but the universe abhors a vacuum. You have to replace the bad habit with the good habit. Otherwise, something else happens, or you become a lot more numb.
Yeah, I'll jump in. I see these two worldviews. It's really about becoming conscious, right? Becoming the active observer in your life. You can see the misaligned worldview as someone that is mindless, and the realigned worldview, mindfulness. So observing your daily habits, this is actually a really great question for someone to ask. What are my rituals? Someone that, you know, is a practitioner of intentional ritualistic ceremonies, being the observer and being conscious of the energy that I'm utilizing, but also being extremely aware of the lesser energies that are still potent, right? Just maybe emotional reactions, how you interact with people, the in-betweens versus the actual big ceremonies of like what you do in the morning. So the lesser or the greater. But this is a question that you could ask people, right? When you ask someone like, hey, what are your rituals? Number one, they're going to have that, you know, preconditioned perception of ritual itself. And then a lot of people haven't even considered, and they're not that conscious observer in their life where they can tell you what their habits are. And this is what we're doing, what I'm trying to explain is bringing that mind, that eye, that awareness into the light of knowing what you do on a day-to-day basis. This is, you know, the process of getting to know yourself, mindfulness instead of mindlessness.
I just realized what shirt you're wearing. Look at that, man. That makes Andy look good right there. Thanks, Will.
It's fresh. It's clean. I had to throw it on for today.
Yeah, thank you. I just saw that. Like, oh my gosh. Yeah, you know, one thing that struck me was, I think every once in a while I've gotten sucked into watching one of these primetime shows, and I think your average human being sits on their couch and watches Ritual Murder every night. and they would never think of it that way, but I bet the dark occultists do. I bet they know that they're engaging 90% of the world in ritual murder on a nightly basis. And, you know, it's really not that different from, you know, what we made fun of the gladiators from watching people tear each other apart or fight animals. When you're watching the same kind of stuff night after night after night as a ritual, and, you know, that's just your day-to-day thing. But anyway, I'll pass it on. Who else wants to say something on that topic?
I'll take it. You know, two of y'all have brought up TV shows, and Chris and Jerry know that's what we're going to be talking about soon on the One Great Work Network. But, yeah, as Will was talking about, these unconscious patterns that we are not aware of. And I know a lot of us talk about, you know, living in the present moment now and being aware and learning to observe and just not react. But through these means of repetition and these patterns that we aren't aware of, you know, we start to build our lives, you know, based on that unconscious pattern. Then once we start to break away from that pattern, it kind of throws us into chaos, you know. It you know, like when things don't go that way, you know, we start to react, you know, more in the animalistic nature. So, you know, as most of us talk about, you know, in our work, becoming more aware of what you are doing, you know, like in the now, becoming more aware of your thoughts, of your feelings, and how you behave. And also, too, you know, and this is something that I've had to, you know, realize is, like, being around friends and family, you know, there's a lot of unconscious, you know, patterns and, you know, a lot of unconscious rituals that you may not be aware of, and you may be conscious about other things in life. So when you get around, you know, those loved ones, you may kind of revert back to, you know, those kind of like childlike or kind of childhood, you know, means. And that's something that I'm always trying to work on, you know, myself, you know, especially being around, you know, family, because, you know, you get around certain family at certain times of the year, and then I start to become aware, like, you know, like, why am I, you know, reacting this way, you know, like being around my mom, or, you know, like being around, like, you know, like close friends. But that just comes back to, you know, those unconscious patterns, or not necessarily the rituals, but still kind of, you know, the same modality of being unconscious of our behavior. And, you know, how the rituals can be a thing, because that's something that we usually do, you know, like day to day, you know, like if you are driving to work, or, you know, just, you know, like join the internet set, just getting up. And, you know, we all have our daily rituals, you know, that we do. I know I have mine. I have my nightly rituals. It's just these patterns that we do, you know, like pretty much day to day, that are darn ingrained, you know, in us. But starting to become aware and asking yourself, why is it that I do these rituals, or, you know, why is it that I'm engaged in these patterns? So then, therefore, if it's really not serving, you know, the true goal or the true benefit of what you say you want, then maybe you can start to, you know, produce a new pattern, you know, that can be more productive to what you say you want.
Yeah.
Can I add in something real quick? Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, it does take actual real world changes to change anything. And those little by little changes are habits and rituals. Go ahead, Margaret.
Touching on that, and I think Leslie points to it as well, unconscious habits open the door for mind control to enter. So I was just in Las Vegas last week, actually, y'all, which, by the way, that place feels like hell on earth, not just because of the heat, but also just the vibe of it. But putting that to the side, I was watching the Olympic game,
yep.
USA versus Canada, I noticed in the Pledge of Allegiance, and this is one of the first times in which, you know, I'm now encountering just kind of daily national rituals and things like that. And I was just thinking about the words of the Pledge of Allegiance and how it's a way that we're opting into our own slavery since childhood. And Chris, I know you brought it up on the Misaligned Worldviews episode as well, which was a little bit of a mind opener for me, because it's in a way, probably actually literally, how people like opt themselves in to their own slavery, basically. So
that correlates with the last week's episode, Chris, that you did, The Power of Words. This is part of ritual as well, right? How many people are actually observing the language that they are using, their vocabulary, you know, these vibratory energetic spells that they are casting on themselves or others, or being cast upon themselves. So,
yeah, that's actually totally in line too with the next thing on the list, the next misaligned worldview, saying or repeating phrases or songs or written material without conscious attention to the meaning and context and the moment we are existing in reality. And just saying that makes me feel like I'm standing back in church to listen to everybody repeat words that they haven't really thought about the meaning, and maybe they don't even know the meaning of some of the words. You know? You want to read that realigned version of number two, Marvin?
Yeah, speaking and sharing information with awareness and understanding of its meaning and relevance to the current context, speaking with honesty, honoring your word. And that second part of it, speaking with honesty, honoring your word, that is such a key one here, because the misaligned version is like people justify lying, you know, and they'll say something like, well, everybody does it, like if that's somehow going to justify it. So they're dishonoring themselves and they're just refusing to acknowledge it in those situations.
Yeah, that's the classic, oh, I was just doing my job.
Yep.
You know, why did you kill 20 million people? Oh, boss said I was supposed to. Isn't that what I'm supposed to do? I work in the army, you know?
The counterpart to the collective unconscious is the collective ego. I've read both Jung's collective unconscious and Freud's collective ego. Freud was not terribly off base on the works in collective ego, the primal herd and the primal horde. These concepts about what happens to group mentalities with the misaligned version, you know, the mindlessness of listening to music. You know, it was well understood that, you know, Jim Morrison was likely a naval intelligence asset because of who his father was. Jim, I believe, had admitted that he was into crowd psychology or something like that. Like he liked to read books on crowd psychology and aspects of that. And also Jim is one of the prototypes that was constructed in the 60s for the rock star. You know, you gotta love it. You know, like I work out, I'll strike a Jim Morrison-esque pose in the mirror. It's all right to, you know, look good and accumulate charisma. But, you know, what are you doing when, you know, you're just like, you're singing along and like, father, yes, son, I want to kill you. And you're singing along that because you just love it. But what's that instilling in you, right?
Yeah, that's great.
And then he says, mother, word. I want to F you. So
that word to instill, you know, that sounds like distill it. You know, it's still in you, you know. Man, so many of those classic rock songs have like these things that people hear over and over every day, like 600 times. If you're on a like construction job site, you hear those same classic rock songs over and over and over. Out of those words, of course, they're going to have an effect, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, when kids listen to those songs, you know, they play them hundreds and hundreds of times. Because I did the same thing when I was a child. You know, like you listen to a few songs over and over and over and over and over. You know, so, you know, you got to, you know, the social engineers are good at getting that program into the kids' minds. So, but yeah, another good book to read on the crowd is by Gustav Le Bon, and it's just called The Crowd. You know, so to add along with the two good books that was Zero Life said, I think I pronounced it correct.
Zero Life, that's all right. Yeah, don't stress it. I had to pick a hard name for myself.
Yeah, those the other aspect that occurred to me, what you were saying, Brandon, I've looked into hypnotism before, and hypnotism, a huge part of hypnotism is repetition.
Yeah.
And, you know, like even if you were going to try to hypnotize yourself, a big part of that game would be repeating phrases to yourself, programming, right?
Yeah, which we all can be using that same method to reprogram ourselves. That's something that I've been using for at least 8 years, is repeat, because it works. The social engineers use it, you know, so that is a good way for us to learn something new or to learn, you know, new modalities. So that's something that we all should be incorporating, you know, it's repetition, but use it on the more positive means and not as a means of indoctrination, but use it as a means of actually learning to actually get a definitive knowing, you know, like when it comes to natural law, you know, constantly go back, you know, to the source material to where you actually know it and not just believe, or, you know, you're not just, you know, you're just not repeating what someone else is, you know, said. You got to get it programmed into your own, you know, subconscious. So that's something that I constantly, you know, use, you know, help myself as far as learning, because it works.
And being aware of those catchphrases that we all say, we get stuck in, like if you're working somewhere and everybody says, oh, thank God it's Friday, you know, and you catch yourself just saying it, and then you're like, why am I even saying that? You know, like, stop and think about the words that are coming out of your mouth, and do you really mean them, or are you just saying them because other people are saying them? Because some of these words can be very destructive when you say them over and over. Your body and your mind and your spirit are all, like, working together, but you're not conscious of every little thing happening. You know, you don't tell your body, like, always when to burp or when to fart. Like, it tells you, you know, some of these things. So when you're just putting out words and programs, it's not, it's just doing what you're telling it. It's working towards what you're saying. So if you're programming it like terrible things, it's starting to sink in. It's starting to instill itself into your organs and your tissues, you know.
I've removed, like, you know, a lot of new agers, they do like Grand Rising. I like Grand Rising, but I've removed good morning from my vernacular, because why should we start the day with sorrow? Why do I greet you when the sun rises with the sorrows? The sun has risen. You know, the life affirming light of the world is hanging out for a few hours. I'm pretty damn happy about it. So I'll say good dawn. Or, you know, or Grand Rising if I'm, like, going to Leo out a little bit for the day. You know what I mean? But, you know, it's more gentle on the good dawn. So, you know, that's all, like, vernacular control. And of course, you know, mantras. Anybody doing meditation, right? You know, it means something on a deep primordial level if you're Om Namah Shivaya, like, all the time, right? And you do it 108 times. Each time you do it, it activates an energy center in your you have the 108 energy centers throughout the body, right? And so, you know, when you do 108 of a mantra, that mantra activates every single one of those energy
meridians,
centers, right?
Yeah,
those meridians. Thank you. That was the word, right? And so that makes me think a lot about what's more cursed or whatever. You know, as a metalhead, I've had to refine a whole lot. You know, I still got a Dimmu Borgir flag behind me, and I don't want to hear too much shit about that. but you know, it's just like, you know, there's the dark side of most of metal is a dark side. But there's the dark side that's good, and then there's the dark side that's bad, right? And it takes a lot of wisdom to know the difference.
And yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying that, you know, being conscious, you know. What were you about to say, Marvin?
On the topic of mantras and just kind of, I guess I'll just say, like, little chants that I think people do in their lives and they're not even aware of them. Like, I've tried to invert those as much as I can to wherever there's actually a seems like secretly negative. Like, one of them, for example, is people say, "You're welcome," after, you know, you did a favor for them and somebody says thank you. I've actually started robbing from Chick-fil-A here, and I say my pleasure now because I want to actually convey that it's not a like subservient servant dynamic. It's my pleasure to help. I'm happy to help. So I've stopped saying you're welcome. I now say my pleasure. That was just a little thing I noticed that I actually like. And instead of thank you, I more often now say I appreciate you. And that one just came from, you know, I hear people say it, and I just thought that really conveys it more. I appreciate you. You did something cool, and I appreciate that, but I appreciate you for that. So these are just like little phrases and words that we use in our daily lives. And there's nothing wrong with thank you or you're welcome, by the way. So I don't want to paint a negative picture of those phrases.
I like using the word, you know, I like saying my gratitude. And I'm very big on a lot of things, putting the hand to the heart to say like, no, seriously, from the heart, my gratitude. And then one day Balder will be risen and it'll be, oh, that was the last gratitude.
Those are good points. This goes really well with the first realigned worldview, right? What we're talking about. Because you have the intention, the mental marker, and then you add it with the vibratory, the voice, the vibration and energy. And that is extremely powerful. Unfortunately, in the modern age, right, with everyone so conditioned and programmed, words don't have that intention behind it. So, you know, words like, oh, I'm sorry, or even thanks, right? It doesn't have that intention or that energy. So these words be taken for granted, or they don't have any meaning. And the last line, speaking with honesty and honoring your word. I remember talking with my grandpa when he was alive, and he was a farmer, and they didn't do contracts because their word was their bond. Bond means to bind.
Yep.
Just speaking it, I will do this and you will do this for me, or whatever the verbal agreement, you had that integrity and you stuck to your word. You followed through. If you say something, do it. Act on that. And, you know, nowadays there's just the relativistic mindset and the egotism and, you know, the dog-eat-dog world. That integrity and that honesty is lacking in a lot of individuals, right? Especially that first stage of really doing the shadow work is being honest with yourself. And this applies to how you speak and how you act, right? And how you think.
Yeah, I think you really see it if you go somewhere where someone has a public service type job and they say the same thing over and over. Thank you. Enjoy your ride. Thank you. Enjoy your ride.
Thank you. Come again.
You know, like you're like, you don't really care, do you? You know what I mean? You're not really saying thank you. Yeah. You know, so I think that makes a lot of sense that you put the intention behind what you say by adding that extra little bit of creativity, thinking about how you say it and not just saying it the same. Let's see. Let's check at number three. And I think this is kind of pointing in the same direction of how we express our creativity. Expressing our creativity is great until we use it to coerce or scare people. So number three, misaligned, wearing costumes, outfits, decorations that intimidate, purposely separating and dividing humans by class, position, gender, or age.
And then the inverse, encouraging others to express their creativity, appreciating all kinds and types of free expressions that do not harm others. If uniforms are useful for distinguishing oneself or a group of individuals, do so for the purpose of helping others. So what I kind of tried to capture with this one is that I think there are times where a uniform actually is necessary and helpful, just on a purely utilitarian level. You know, if we're out somewhere, I think we'd want to know if there's someone who intends to help others medicinally, for example. So I can see the value from that side of things. It just boils down to the intent behind that. And sometimes uniforms are used to dismiss other perspectives or and harm others. So COVID, anyone? COVID as one example. So,
I mean, it's also like uniforms themselves ought to be restructured because, you know, you could do major presentations on the de-occulting of the symbolism of uniforms, why you have the certain star shapes for certain officers, the certain badge insignias for certain officers, different stripes, and all the kinds of information that can tell you. And is that being used for mind control? Is that used for accountability so you have a sense of their history? But then again, like, does it show you the mark for where he screwed up as an officer, or the mark where, well, he didn't get in trouble, but just letting you know he had to kill a guy, right? Right. What's the mark? What does it all mean? What's it telling you about this person who has, you know, made some sort of an oath to a duty that you don't want to be out of alignment?
The
go ahead, Brandon.
The main thing that stuck out in number three, freedom of expression that does not, you know, create harm. And sadly, you know, a lot of people think that freedom just means to, you know, do as you please. And that's not what we are talking about. You know, like when we're talking about freedom, we're talking about, you know, within the parameters of right and wrong, you know, within the guidelines of natural law, you know, so you're free to do as you please, as long as it doesn't transgress against someone else's, you know, property rights. And then you have the creative, you know, outlet, the creative expression. We all should be creative, but, you know, sadly, a lot of people think they are creative, but, you know, they're just falling under cult indoctrination or collectivist, you know, mentality. So it's not a real form of authenticity. You know, like when we're talking about, you know, like being creative, you know, like we're talking about you as an individual, you know, creating. And, you know, we all have our different flavors. We all have our different likes. We all have our different preferences, you know, so that's how we use it as a means to outlet the kind of, you know, share our experiences, share, you know, like how we feel as a means to help express. And, you know, like we are all trying to teach, you know, help our natural law, and we all have our own unique ways of doing it, you know, and that's our creative outlet. So it has to come from a conscious individual, you know, understanding, and not an unconscious collective, you know, cult indoctrination, which would lead to the whole, you know, the whole uniform, you know, part two.
Mm. Well said, man. I love that. Yeah, you know, uniform, the definition of uniform is only having one form. So how it's used nowadays, right, is to identify one's ideologies. You look at the military and the police, even schooling with school uniforms, right? It's all to atomize, to mix them all together into one form. So I see a lot of...
homogenize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Mm-hmm. How about universe, the one thing that we say?
Yeah, for sure. Unity, right? But that comes down to the understanding. Like, we do have a true unity in that we're consciousness alive having an experience. So it really depends on the actions that are involved, right? If someone has a group or organization and they want to have some kind of matching uniforms and stuff, so be it. I mean, if that's their how they want to express themselves, but what are the actions?
Will's wearing the End Evil shirt.
Exactly, for sure. Of course, when you get into government institutions and the false claim of authorities where they, you know, they want to coerce and mandate some type of uniformity, then you're getting into the violation of rights and the, you know, working against creativity for sure. So a lot of people nowadays, especially in culture, that freedom of expression and creativity has been inverted with, you know, almost a hidden message. It's like a badge of the dominant ego you know, dyeing your hair all one color. I mean, you look at, just look at flags and communism and socialism having, or America, any kind, type of country. So these type of flags, it's like, what does it mean? What are the actions behind it? The patterns speak volumes. And I think that is what is really important for sure. And people are, you know, they're afraid. They're fearful to be ostracized from their group, that group mentality, that group think. This is something that I, you know, creativity and free expression, I promote this with my daughter. My daughter likes to wear crazy stuff, and she just doesn't give a fuck what people say or what people, you know, think of her when, if she's wearing unmatching stuff or some, you know, weird tutu or something like that. I don't think it's weird. Other people might, but see, it's that fear that people have of not fitting in, not going with the flow in the herd.
Which is like not being comfortable with your own self and your own value.
Yeah. To be ostracized by the group, you know, in most people's mind equates to death.
That's right.
The one of the biggest things I've been taking away, I've been slowly over time on my channel been reading Heidegger's Being and Time, right? And so I've been getting a firm grasp of the principle of Dasein, which is your state of being in the world, right? And, you know, I've had a lot of this struggle, and I realized there was one chapter, because there's a lot of the conversation about the existential in the books, right? There's your world that is developed from your experience in where you are and when you are. But then there's the state of the world that's beyond your direct influence, right? And so your imagination can run wild with how big the world that is telling you no is. Kind of like Freud's, like, I think it was like the superego, we said, was the one that was constantly like holding you back, right? Like this is the world, this is the Jormungandr energy, okay? You know, if we're gonna invoke over here, right? So this is the world serpent, right? It's just like, it's coming in, the walls are closing in. You know, it's just like you feel like everybody in the world wants you to get a haircut. And if you don't get a haircut, your life will be miserable, because nobody will respect you, take you seriously, give you a shot at anything, right? And so, in short, you will not be allowed in the world if you do not conform to the world's likings. These are all the interests of the world. All of its concerns about who you are, and you are not approved until these things change. And your parents don't know any better, so they repeat what the world serpent tells them to you.
Great point. Great point.
Yeah, Leslie says, this is powerful. Absolutely. Anybody else want to add to that?
Yeah, one last thing is people are associating their creativity with their identity, and you know, like the etymology of that word just means sameness, you know, to be the same. So that's why you see a lot of people, you know, they think that they are being creative, and then they're constantly talking about, here's what I identify with, here's what, you know, here's my, you know, like, how, for identity, which none of that really, you know, represents you, none of that is truly you, you know, like at your truest self. So
Yeah, the personas that people wear, the masks.
Yeah, the mask.
Oh,
what's
yes.
going on, Fred?
What's up,
Fred's
Fred?
Joining us. I've been just listening through Mark Passio's Two Masks, One Face. So every time I hear that word mask, good stuff.
Great presentation that everybody should watch. Fantastic.
Talking about incredibly concise information just being laid out like bricks. It's pretty intense.
And extremely relevant.
Yeah.
Right. How are you doing, Fred? Thanks for joining us, brother.
I'm doing great, actually. Thank you. I'm trying to get through this fucking software on the phone. I never use it on the phone. So was listening to your conversation, and I think there was what I keep coming back is shadow working and the inner work. I think the basis of that is fundamentally interconnected with everything due to the principle of correspondence. And there's many things that can be covered in even just starting the work, just doing something, and you don't know where to start. We gather so much information, you know, during our great work, then we have to put an order into that and then put our energy and our time in preciously manage, and we have to take in consideration that in this work, nothing is easy. This incredible discovery about the self and the world is a ongoing work for everybody who is doing the work, and we have to stay humble and have humility into that, and just allowing ourselves to make mistakes and having hard conversation with people. And this is what the one part that is difficult is to do it locally. It's to do it, at work or in the family or things like that, and really push it to the next level. And it's going out of the echo chambers from social media and this hellhole we created for ourselves. The social media as such are useful tools, but the way it is used is ridiculous beyond belief. I don't want to take too much of your time. Thank you for having me, Chris.
Thank you, Fred. Well said, and it ties in so well to what we're saying about intentionality. You know, each of these topics we're talking about, you know, your intentions are so important. And when you are conscious and have done your own self-work, then you're not going to get so easily sucked into the group think or the words that other people are saying. Number four of the misaligned worldviews was gathering in crowds, using the team spirit or mob mentality to confuse, awe, or shock groups of people, especially to convince.
And then the inverse, foster group gatherings that encourage critical thinking, mutual respect, and individual expression rather than coercion. Be sure that all groups or gatherings are only bound by natural law principles. Let every individual retain all right to choose for themselves and not be drawn into any obligation by membership or association. And one actual little example of that was right at the start of this meeting. You know, I actually liked when Brandon asked, when he saw the document, why did you guys choose inversion? And just kind of pointing out that that word maybe might not be what we were intending to say. I think questions are great because they force us, you know, to think about what it is that we are actually doing. And questions in groups can often be discouraged. And I think it's because, you know, questions can make people kind of, I don't know, just kind of tense up, you know, almost. And so I've talked to Chris before about what I call perhaps an unfair speaker's responsibility. And that unfair responsibility is that the speaker, you know, has to be able to express their ideas, stand by them, but also welcome questions, because if you don't, then people lose trust, people lose respect. And so I think the welcoming of questions, of critical thinking, of mutual respect supports people asking each other questions, you know, and looking to understand and going from there.
We absolutely have to go out of our comfort zone. We need to do it. It's not like it's an option. we have to do it. We have to get out of these echo chambers and the repeating and the things like that. I know most of us do a lot of repeating. It's part of our job, and we have to put the information out and being as concise and logical and having the care to the care. It's always a good, an important point on that. And how much do you care? This is where this is a limit actually for most people because they don't even care about themselves. So we have to bring back this, seemingly, stolen, part of ourselves. And I don't agree with that. I don't think it's stolen. I think it's regressed and it's keep in or the subconscious. Right. And yeah, like I think all our powers are dormant because of where, in how the condition we are living and the food we take in and the air and every factors, you know, the psychological, emotional, aspect of it that is as it's more important even in the meta and what is happening in the mental of the aggregates.
Yeah, and it's really common when people don't have that self-critical or self-observant just to kind of what everybody else is doing, there's a lot of pressure. There's just a general peer pressure. And you don't even really feel it until you're going against the flow. And so it's hard to point at something that someone doesn't isn't aware of. You know, like how would you find something if you weren't looking for it? You know, any other thoughts on how this goes with crowds, mob mentality, the group spirit, how people are swayed in groups?
I'll jump in there. Yeah, this is a real big one because, you know, humans, all life has that social aspect on certain levels. We all want to interact, and this is inherently, we want to interact with nature. Human beings being a species that is social and wants to interact as well. Nowadays, people call it, you know, the tribal mentality. The problem is, like stated in the realigned worldviews, the natural law principles, first principles, that morality, the foundation isn't there. So nowadays, the unconscious masses, they are getting together with groups and it becomes a codependent powwow where people are supporting their cognitive biases. And like what Marvin said, there isn't that foundational step of teachability and open-mindedness where criticism might not be there. Might be implemented or not received. So these codependent groups, it's just enforcing incorrect thinking and immoral behaviors. And it's really kind of, it's putting consciousness in a box. It's a limiter. And I have no problem with people coming together. And, you know, I get along with all different types of groups of people and awareness. But the first principles, that is the foundation, foundational layer that must be there for really any type of group to be moral, open-minded, and to evolve in by whatever means that group is trying to go for. And even on the algorithm, we see this on the internet, right, where you got the consolidation of like-minded individuals, keeping them in a box of awareness. So it's a slippery slope.
Will, you took the words right out of my mouth because without principles, whenever you have any group dynamic, that group dynamic can always be led astray. But see, when you have principles and those principles are adhered to, then you have a means and a reason for accountability and responsibility. Because without that, then what's going to be the means to measure, you know, a healthy behavior within that group? So when you have the principles, you have something to measure as far as, you know, how behavior of individuals, you know, within that group. And therefore, you can hold people held accountable, which first, you know, you have to hold yourself held accountable to first, then you can start to hold, you know, others held accountable. So yeah, principles have to come first, especially in the group dynamic, because you never know what someone's intent is. You never know what someone's means are. You never know what someone's true goals and purpose is as far as when they join the group. So without those principles, there is not going to be any form of cohesion or, you know, like any form of integration, because principles are the most important thing.
One of the things that I find interesting, because I've been quite a networker, right? And I've run with many different groups, and I've learned a lot about the fact that a lot of these guys, those groups, don't operate from core principles. They're just like-minded friends, right? You know, they're in it because of a certain common belief systems, a certain kind of conversation they like to have. But like, other than that, it's just sometimes it's good, but you know, sometimes it's just there for like friends to like kill time together. Right. You know, cause like, you know, if I'm in a group that's like a Tartaria group, I'm hanging out with them, and then I discover something that I'm interested in talking about that historical time period that skewers the conversation about Tartaria in particular, you know, it's not going to want to be heard in the group. It's just like, no, we want to stubbornly keep going with this assumption because it's fun, right? As opposed to seeing that, well, maybe this one thread kind of makes the thing fall apart. It's kind of important to look at it, because if it's true, you just look like a fool. But you can't look like a fool if you aren't seen. So these groups, they just run, you can't bother us over here. And now nobody knows who the hell your group is anymore, and you have no power.
Well said. Great example.
Yeah, and our modern, like Fred was pointing out, social media platforms we're using, they got people so fractured and divided and so many groups and subgroups. I mean, any of us that have tried to do work online at this point, you've got 12 different modes of communication. You don't think there's going to be problems, you know? Actually, I think a lot of the modern things that have been created technologically that seem like advantages of communication are actually breaking down our ability to communicate. But I'm going to go ahead and move on to number five, misaligned worldviews. Displaying fake miracles, claiming stories to be true that are impossible to corroborate, to awe or mesmerize with trickery. So good example of that probably going on in the news right now, I imagine. It's getting close to a presidential thing, so something's got to happen, right? We got to awe the people.
So much weirdness around that. The flip of it, though, sharing genuine experiences and verifiable stories that inspire and uplift others without deceit, choosing stories and myths to inspire coming generations, putting messages through thorough consideration. Clearly define the stories, myths, and fables as fictional so that young ones are not confused by lies and distorted reality belief structures, to provide children with an accurate, clear version of reality. So a couple weeks ago, actually, because I talk about the topic of telling truth and justifying lies with people, and a parent told me that, yes, you know, I like the concept of adherence to truth, blah, 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 but think about the concept of Santa Claus. You know, Santa Claus for me as a parent is a way of motivating a child to do good. You know, they like the whole ritual of gifts for Christmas and all of that sort of thing. So how could I do that without a concept of Santa Claus? And to me, the answer was obvious. If you're going to use Santa Claus, just tell them that Santa Claus isn't real. It's fine. Like, we have fictional heroes. We have fictional characters. We grow up with that even as children. So you don't need to trick a child into thinking Santa is real. And by the way, even better if you can motivate your child to do good through teaching of morals. But let's just pretend that they need Santa Claus. You don't need Santa Claus to be real. You can have a concept of a Santa Claus while teaching your child from early on that it's a fiction.
And it's trauma. It's trauma. You actually traumatize your child because, you know, yep. like the kid looks up to you as a steward, and it, you know, the kid trusts you. Then it finds out you've been lying to me, you know, all these years. You're traumatizing, you know, your child.
Yep.
We call this ontological shock, right? When a proof of the world reveals itself and it shatters your paradigm, right? This is ontological shock. And, So you have to completely reassess who you are. Like I said, I'm reading Heidegger, right? That gives you your awareness very much like – it's very subjective awareness, right? It's very much like my hands, the objects in the room, the room itself, the distance between them and what is most – available to me versus what takes effort to bring to me within my scope of reach. And then you've got Ayn Rand's epistemology of objectivism, which is kind of like the other side of the equation, where, hold on, there's six different sides to this item in my hand. There are six different angles in which I can understand this subject right here, right? Because you're taking it from outside of just your subjective single point of view. And then you're finding reality by like kind of hallucinating the truth between those two filters of reality that we perceive.
Mm. Yeah, that's deep there. And that I find personally, ever since I've been doing this work, the understanding of the difference between subjective and objective and being able to look at things, you know, kind of zoom in and out with your mind from the macro to the micro is something that is not taught in school and something that I think an ability that some people just aren't ever exposed to in the modern world because so many things are so materialistic and just repeat, do what I say, instructional-based teaching. Repetition-based teaching, a lot of people don't even get that whole extra layer of creative thought that you can back out. Imagine you're somewhere else. Imagine you're something else. Imagine you're looking at it all from not your point of view, you know? And people I've spoken
to ourselves
with
about the human condition, right? The human condition in the scientific psychological world really kind of goes with the human is defined as monster. Like motif, right? We tell our children Santa Claus is real because we don't believe they would do good without that creature. And we believe this because somebody told us this is the human condition and this is a healthy way to introduce your child to a god, right? What the fuck is Santa Claus? Santa Claus is every bearded deity wrapped into one for its winter solstice seasonal motif. Primarily Thor, by the way, but you could wrap up all sorts of bearded deities of Jupiterian or Saturnian ilk and put it in there in its wintertime assortment with the themes of the culture of the time. And this is really where this figure of our winter solstice comes from that we couldn't quite tear away. We could completely water it down like the way we turned the Celtic gods into leprechauns.
Yeah, I have a really easy solution there. Just don't fucking lie. It's simple.
Yeah. Of course.
That's right.
And the thing is, it's such a great way to sell candy.
Right.
And toys.
You guys are touching on good points, and Chris, you touched on exactly what I was going to bring up, and first I'll start with a quote by Michael Elner. He's a very well known hypnotist. He said, "He who controls the paradigm is God," and this is obviously about, you know, perception management and influence. And one thing we lack in the world nowadays is that philosophical, allegorical, symbolic, archetypal metaphysical mind. Really, that's at the heart of pattern recognition. And that creates a whole lot of problems, right? One thing we can see, even within the freedom truth community, when an event happens, it's that quick dopamine hit of being the first one to, you know, drop the theory, the conspiracy theory. This is what it is. This is what happened. Go left field and right field. And I'm all for speculation, but within minutes or hours of an event, you already have a conclusion, and this is what happens. That's not stepping into critical thinking, right? Where you're applying the trivium and gathering all the grammar, and then even then using your words of my opinion or speculation. It's that cognitive fortitude that people grasp onto, and you know the subconscious mind. Everything's real for the subconscious. This is going to little kids and Santa Claus and monsters under the bed. It is completely real to them. So when they get that shock, it is absolutely traumatic. So I think a rich moral culture that is free will have also a rich culture of mythology and stories as well, because that's the power of the mythos. It does have that philosophical, allegorical, symbolic aspects of the mind, the left and the right brain, and it's incorporated in our evolution, our story, the story of nature, the story of truth. And this is why a lot of the mythos are from thousands and thousands of years ago and are still here today and are powerful examples if understood for self-development, knowledge of truth.
Yeah, we were hitting on that too. Will Zerilath was mentioning, you know, like with the uniforms, with the stars and such, there's so much symbolism embedded in all these authoritarian structures in place, whether it be flags or the hats they're wearing or the costumes. So we have to become aware of what symbols mean and be more familiar. That's part of the number eight that we're going to get to. One of the occult powers out there is that symbols are like words times 10. They have massive words packed inside of them, and they can be used to affect our minds. So we have to understand symbology and understand what symbols we're using and putting out there. So number six on the misaligned list, misaligned worldviews happen partly because people are trusting or using ancient as a means of authentication or by popularity, believing in mass that something is true because we all know of it, and it has been around for a long time, then they incorrectly justify that therefore it must be true because it's ancient or because everybody else believes it.
And then the realigned version is evaluating beliefs and traditions critically, understanding their historical context and relevance, and accepting or rejecting them based on evidence and reason. Practice objectivity and recognize things that cannot be known for certain. Prioritizing the concepts and ideas that can be garnered so we as individuals and as a society can more quickly adapt and adjust. One of these pivotal moments for me, and you know, Larkin Rose and Keith Knight actually were, I think, pivotal to helping me flip this in my head. But I hear often about the idea that you know, slavery has always existed, so every institution is always going to be corrupted, and people are animals, so their nature is dog eat dog. Like, I was trained on that, like that's something that I grew up believing, and for a long time, like in my early 20s, just operated off of that belief. So like in my career, for example, I'd be the person that justifies like lying or manipulation because, you know, it's a dog eat dog world. So I need to do this in order to move up in the world. And so I realized, though, that that's not true. Even in our like day to day lives, none of us here operate on a dog-eat-dog basis in our daily lives. And so that just realization was, I think, key for me, because what I realized is it's a way for powerful people to get away with doing evil acts, since other people will just look at that and go, well, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world, so and it's always been this way, so it's always going to be this way. And yet the truth of, like, pivotal inventions, for example, has been that they didn't exist up until the moment that they existed. And once it existed, it's a part of life, you know, the light bulb, harnessing fire. Prior to that, somebody might have said, oh, well, there's no way that we can use fire because it's always been this way. We can't use fire, and yet now we're harnessing fire. So I think this belief that slavery always has to exist, that people will always be corrupted, that it's a dog-eat-dog world, I think is one of those, is an example of that, where once you learn that that's not true, you can't really unring that bell because you just see how that's just been wrong the entire time.
I can share a little part there. When I stumbled upon Mark's work, I wanted to test the information in order to understand it. So what I did is align myself with these principles by understanding them. And I'm telling you guys, the natural laws and all the occult knowledge are very powerful, and they're life changing. This is where we have to draw a line. You know, it's a very insidious, perverted world that we're living in, and we have to keep our head up, and we have to always grow. This stagnation condition is everywhere. You were talking about group mentality there, and what truth and true discovery, and the best way, at my opinion, is to test it yourself. You know, bend it a little bit. You need to fucking dive right into it and go through all these because there are steps, you know. And why do I talk about shadow work a lot? Because there, it's interconnected with the principle, the hermetic principles, and how to slow down the swing. This is a principle of rhythm problem that we have. The people are having high, and they have low, and there's no control. There's no neutral zone. The breath is shortened because of that. People are stressed because people have this venomous need for validation. And then you have the victimization behind it. The victimization is everywhere. You have people with heavy Stockholm syndrome, and even us as humans, as brothers and sisters, we are keep on fighting against this programming, and it's changing all the time. So we have to move on. You know, we have to go further and explore this information. And when it comes to truth, well, you know, nature is truth. So you don't have to go far, you know, to observe it. You just take a minute. You stop thinking about all this craziness that we're living in, and you can see it right there. You know, you place yourself by the window and you can see it, you know, this incredible world that we're living in. It's not all black, you know, there's beautiful things. There's beautiful people who are working hard to make this world better. And this is where we have to put our energy in.
Yeah, I think, Fred, one of the ways people really can do that, and my advice is try, like, actually listening to something, taking in some information that you disagree with up front.
Yeah.
And listen to it and sit through it. You don't have to agree with something to listen to it. And it's a good practice to be able to listen to something and take something in that you don't necessarily agree with and just let it sit and see where it goes. You know, that will give you advantage. Don't be afraid to have, you know, to listen to information and hear both sides of things. So that would be my challenge for people to work on not falling for that trick of just believing something because it's old or everybody else believes it. Jerry, you've been kind of quiet. You want to pop in on anything before I move on to the next one?
I really like what Fred said. And something that I was thinking of was we might talk about problems because people need to be aware of them. However, I do think that there's still the possibility of freedom. So on to the next one, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, the sooner we're able to see it for what it is, we can work towards it. But people are easily fooled, and we see that on a large scale. One of the ways that's done is through this whole God situation. Number seven, often belief structures and misaligned worldviews are due to people claiming a direct and unique link to God, pretending to be that unique link, believing that you are or must be that unique select chosen one, and that's how it's done. That whole... Oh, go ahead, Marvin, you want to read the...
Positive? please. I'm zipping myself.
I was just saying that's an extremely dangerous one. You know, we can think all through history, people claiming to be the messenger of God, and if you really believe that, then what keeps you from doing anything, you know, that otherwise might be called murder or rape if you said, oh, well, God told me to, and so did this book. You know, if everyone does that, then where are we?
And so for the realigned version of this, I really took it to the level where I think every individual is going to have, just by definition, a direct and unique link to God. So the way that it came out is supporting individuals discovering their direct and unique link to God. So practice physically, mentally, and spiritually to refine your connection with the divine truth and keep the door open to be wrong and to be corrected and relearn lessons you thought you mastered. Humility and pride balance male and female parts of yourself. Seek excellence. So I think it's all in the words there. The part that starts to broach upon others is when you say, only I can achieve this. You cannot. So simple as that. And because of that, you need to trust what I say. That's the part that is wrong.
Yeah, being the arbiter of truth. We've seen this in the cultural religions like crazy, where, you know, even murder and genocide has been happening. And we continue to see this in scientism and government, where they what they say goes, right? They're the arbiter. And even within the parental dynamic, right? Brandon mentioned, you know, we're stewards. We're entrusted to one's care, with one's care. And the arbiter of truth and quote unquote authority as parents claim and act upon has the same type of effects, and that's, you know, that's promoting control and slavery. So, yeah.
An amazing movie that kind of reflects on this that I just recently saw, but it came out in 21, was the wrestling film The Iron Claw. Which, you know, that gets into this whole thing because the Von Erichs family was raised by a guy who was a certain kind of father with his religious inclination. And you see a demonstration through this film of his toxic narcissistic personality traits as he treats the children of his family like they are wrestling for him and literally marking his approval like a championship belt. It's just like, if you do this good, you get all of you get most of my love, and then you're if you do that well, you'll get a second degree of my love and a third degree of my life and rankings for dad's love. And mom is enabling all of this, right? And those decisions torture these guys in ways they don't see as they're pushing their bodies over the limit. And they look great on the outside. They can perform perfect. But the internal toll kills them, or they kill themselves. You know, I flipped things on the script, the chosen one narrative. I thought about that a lot. And I said, no, the problem with that, as good as it feels and sounds, is that it robs you of your agency. Mm-hmm. I am the choosing one. I am the master of my own fate. I'm not waiting for any deity aside from the higher force to move my hand. I move my hand. I have to make those decisions. I have to own it. I can't blame God for my mistakes.
Yeah, and we can fuck it up at any moment, too.
You can blame the devil.
Yeah, and then like I'm sorry, the All-Father has nothing to do with this one.
Yeah, that one was all me.
You know, that's another reason why first principles are so important, right? With first principles, you understand self-responsibility, accountability, but also then respecting one's own journey of discovery of themselves and of the Great Spirit, that we're all on that journey to build that relationship with ourselves, the All, Great Spirit, and with each other. And having the first principles there as that foundation, it really enhances active imagination and creativity within the individual, but mainly within society as well, in the aggregate.
I don't know about you guys, but my own personal relationship with God or the divine, I've had all kinds of interesting and wonderful moments in my life where just something inspirational has sort of like popped into my head as I'm walking through the trees, or I'm watching some weird movie on Netflix and it lines up with something I heard Will Keller say, or a book I'm reading. You know, it comes from unexpected places. Sometimes just looking at a bird and how a bird's flying gives me some sort of deep feeling within. But all these things, like, they don't mean so much when I tell you guys about them, like, oh, I had this unique experience at the lake when I saw a bird. I mean, I could tell you and you can sort of feel it. But the thing about this whole relationship with God and the divine is that it's so unique to each of us. And we each have that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And all this stuff is discoverable for every human being and every life form, you know, to discover reality, discover their connection to reality. And it's such a fucking slap in the face when some people come out here and say, oh, we have the bones of Saint Christopher. I'm going to use my own name to make fun of that. And you have to kiss these bones and pray to these bones, or if you touch them, they're going to heal you, or some shit like that. If you think about it, like, these relics and these like stories about miracles are a real slap in the face to the actual miracle of our connection to the divine and how awesome and amazing and intangible and yet tangible it is, you know.
It's a deeply like perverted exploitation of necromancy, right? Like necromancy is not supposed to be evil. Necromancy is like, I miss my grandma, I'm gonna go to the burial mound and leave an offering for her. I want to feel connected with the spirit, maybe get some ancestral wisdom. Right. Like, this is, you know, these are aspects of necromancy. Some of it can be a little bit more extreme, but at the same time, you know, a neutral practice can be used for good or for evil. And you're looking at quite the exploit for evil with the way they do it in their system.
Mm-hmm. Great point.
So I had a guest on the Libercast not long ago, and she was a Christian from the Adventists of the Seventh Day. It's a branch of Christianity and I had her on the conversation, and very interesting. And I suggest everyone to go look at that, this particular podcast, because I wanted to have a conversation with her on a neutral ground, and asking about her ideas and the ideology and what it is, and it was very interesting in this sense. So there's many patterns that keep on coming back, and then you have this blind belief into something. You know, they're abandoning their, this is all salvationism. So for the people, just go see that. You know, just salvationism is a good part of it. You know, people have to abandon themselves to something intangible. And there's some cults aspect to it. Depends on what denomination the people choose. But essentially, there's a lot of fear, the fear porn, you know, this fucking... if you're not doing this, you know, you're not going to be taken by Christ, and everybody else is dirty and things like that. Things that keep on coming back. And there's even a passive aggressive in the conversation. This is not an aggressive conversation, but it's a... yeah, really passive aggressive approach, and it's very telling from where the people, what they believe they become and what they are. You know, there's a very big difference between the two. The perceptions are very powerful when it comes to religions and creeds.
Chris, can you read Rick's chat of what he just said about him rediscovering that connection with God? Because that's what I was going to say, because we all, you know, like we all have that connection, but some of us may just have to rediscover it more. And that connection is going to be unique to the individual, you know, so your connection may be totally different than my connection and then the next person's connections, you know. Yeah, we all have to rediscover that.
Yeah, and that's going to be an ongoing relationship connection I've had throughout my life. I'd say, I feel like, you know, one guy walked up to me, he's like, have you ever been born again? And I was like, yeah, actually like 3 times, bro. And I'm not joking, I'm totally serious. You know, I feel like at least 3 or 4 times in my life I've like really thrown away a lot of my past belief systems and restructured them and started kind of fresh, you know, a few times. You know, if you're not willing to do that, you know, that's the fire of alchemy. That's part of the process of rebirthing yourself into becoming anew. Our body, every part of it, I've heard in 7 years, changes itself out. You know, it's not the same skin you had 7 years ago. You shouldn't be the same person you were 7 years ago. If you're growing, you know, everything else is growing. If it's not, it's dying. And that's the two things that we have in life that are constant. You know, ultimately, the last worldview thing to be discussed is occulted truths. And occult, if you don't know, comes from oculus, to see. So things that are hidden are occulted. And part of the reason, the primary reason why we as humans are in the situation we're in, dealing with so much evil on our day-to-day basis and so fractionalized and so cut up and confused with all these religious belief systems, is because we don't understand the truth behind it all, the principles, the hermetic principles like Fred brought up and the things like Zarathustra brought up, the objective ability to look at things with the bigger mind, right? So the will of the great all can be discovered. It can be discovered within ourselves on a personal level, and then we can share that with others. And that is what we're trying to do here. And the main gist of the show is do that work inside and then teach, share, learn with others until we all understand natural law. And we don't have to be fooled by the workings of the dark occultists who are trying to occult the truth that we can discover for free within ourselves. And we don't need anybody else but ourselves to do that. We just have to be willing and have that intention. So go around. Any last thoughts on that? And then we'll close it up for the evening.
People can tell when others lie, and they feel it. They even show that they feel it, like they can sense it. The part that is really difficult is to then call it out from there. So for me, when I read the teaching, Occulted Truths, is all about almost like fighting against my own fear, so I can take that next step of calling out and observing what I see and training myself to do that as comfortably as I can. That's it.
Yeah, I'll dive in for closing statement. I really like how you have teaching occulted truth, right? Teaching occultism. We're talking about the science of the psyche and nature that's been hidden from the public's awareness. So, you know, the huge part of doing the one great work that anyone can do and everyone should do is conveying the occult art and sciences that have been hidden from the public intentionally, right, to cause a power vacuum. And this is what we're here to do first ourselves, is to understand the occult art and sciences ourselves, apply them to our own lives, but also express that in a variety of forms, right? When people read occult works that are, you know, hundreds of years, sometimes thousands of years old, they're in that time period, that context. So it can be hard for people to understand and digest. And this is a big part of what we need to do as educators of truth and morality, is really understand the occult arts and sciences and convey that as best as possible. And you know, this is why I propagate, you know, the worldview of animism, because animism has that balance of objectivity and subjectivity. It's not one or the other. It's I am having a subjective experience in an objective reality. The objectivity is reality and how it operates, but yet I am having my individual experience. So I'm going to have my own self-discovery and relationship with creation and my relationship to the world. You know, the Native Americans always referred to everything, rocks, plants, animals, humans, as relatives. And they still do that. I know, you know, indigenous peoples that say, hey, what's up, my relative? They do that on all matters, because you understand that we are all connected. We are all together in this objective reality. And that's our goal, is to develop a culture of evolution, truth, morality. That's what we want to cultivate, freedom.
I'll put my parting words on it is that the thinking should always get us to a point where you've figured out how to have people in your world, like not on the internet. I love all you guys. I wish we all were like locals, I wish you're all townies and we could all just do this like in a public square somewhere and have a conversation and people can just eavesdrop walking by in the street, and then we're a demonstration of something, because we get to do things all the time together, right? You know, you have to kind of poke for that. I've got some people here that are a little bit like that. They're not like all the way like us, but they're doing all sorts of stuff in holistics and everything else, and it helps me see the idea for how I would want to carry this level forward, right? So because to beat their social credit score, we have to have a social credit score. We have to have a worth, so that way a lot of people have just enough courage to separate because they have something that looks interesting and safe over here, right? You know, and we work out in the open and we work with none of the obfuscation and the manipulation, and we'll realize that it's not some weird thing that's trying to like separate you from like, you know, happiness and joy and get you away from your family or something weird like that, like what cults do, right? So we get out there and we live it as the example unto the higher force, and it'll catch on quickly.
Great points. I'm gonna keep mine short and sweet. You know, a man needs to get back to the philosophical mind, and I'm gonna quote Chris Nelson in one of his videos. You know, we have to get back to an understanding of the metaphysical and the ontological, which would be the grammar. You know, then we can get to the epistemological, which would be the logic and, you know, the understanding and the knowing of why we know things. And therefore, we can get back to the rhetoric, which would be the ethical, you know, formed and how we communicate and treat others. So, you know, we have to get back to this philosophical mindset and, you know, get back to true thinking and true, you know, true consciousness and the evolution and the higher raising of consciousness.
So I'm saying always the same thing. For the people who are dormant, for the people who have this flame inside of them and they're not doing anything, but it's the time is now. We need people involved into sharing this precious, crucial information, and we need you to badly do the shadow work and do this work on yourself and all these steps. Stop lying to yourself. Stop dreaming and imagining things that doesn't exist and telling lies to other people. We have to be objective. We have to be aligned to this incredible nature that we are sharing all our lives into, and never forget that we're all brothers and sisters, even in our difference of opinions, even if we're not always in parallels, or we have to work together. We have to work on the same page. We need to work hand in hand, and there's no other way for this work to get bigger and having the result that it deserves, because we're not doing it for money. We're not doing it for a materialist thing. We just want freedom and love and care. Here we go.
Beautifully well put. Thank you, Fred. Jerry, any last words?
Yeah, thank you, Fred, because you made me think how important freedom is, because it's the most important thing in, you know, the world. Material things don't matter. Freedom does. So I guess like what I'm trying to say is they don't matter as much as freedom. Freedom is the number one principle. It's like the thing we should all be striving towards. So thanks for reminding me of that, Fred. Now, I wrote some notes here just to finish this off. Sort of like Will Keller says, right? Like, simplify the profound. I almost think of like the Arc 2.0. It's like our job should be to sort of simplify the profound. Give them like, you know, something they can bite onto. But it's not too much, I guess, if that makes any sense. And then you should like be delivering the message like you're talking to a friend. So not like, I don't know, seeming salesy, for lack of better words. And then what else do I have written here? Oh yeah, I thought of like how we're all in the game together. Like, we're all going to have our own experience because we're our own individual consciousness, I guess. And then we're all on a journey. And I like, I think Will Keller said how we need to, you know, develop a culture of morality, ethics, truth, and freedom. So, yeah, definitely realign the worldviews. So thanks for this live stream, Chris, and everyone here.
Yeah, it was great having you guys. Zerlath, really good to meet you, man. I'm beautiful things you shared.
Thank you.
Some really deep thoughts. What was the name of the author you shared a couple times, the book you've been reading on your show?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Martin Heidegger, Being Heidegger. In Time. That book and his name was recommended when I was listening to a Michael Sorion video, and he stressed it as a very important kind of like a mind expanding like book to get into, right? So I jumped right into it, and it made me think of Ayn Rand's epistemology of objectivism, but in the opposite direction, in the subjective manner, in a good way. And so that's what it's really been doing for me. Thank you.
Right on. Well, thanks for coming. And should people check out your show, your work somewhere?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Zerlath Immortal. Here on YouTube is pretty much the core way that I like to put things out. I do those Heidegger readings there, so I have a whole playlist of that. And then I do a bunch of other things because there's a lot of vlogging from my phone that I do. I like to talk when I drive on inspired thoughts, and occasionally I put up a video as well as any other collaborations I've done. I have interviews on there. I have a whole lot of stuff I have on there, plus archives from things I've done on Revolution Radio that was saved, including one of the times that I got to talk to Jordan Maxwell.
Mm. Excellent.
Fantastic.
Rest in peace. Yeah.
You always bring some thought-provoking goodies, Zerlath. I love it.
Yeah, and you know, this just group right here, a testament here, seven people showing up tonight, all doing the great work. And I hope that inspires you listeners. You can be up here with us doing it too. Do it in your own way. Help one of us out. Share the shows. Donate. Check out everybody's work. Do whatever you can do. Let's keep this thing rolling. And thanks so much, guys, for joining me. And we'll be back next week. I don't know what we're going to talk about next week yet, but we'll figure it out.
Much appreciate love, all. You all.
Yeah, I'm going to turn us all off. And yeah. I got a little reel of me talking some more that I'm going to play for us to end the show with. What were you saying, Brandon?
Thanks for joining. And thanks, everyone, for coming. Marvin, thank you for helping Chris create that. And Zerlath, it was good meeting you.
Yeah.
Right on. Cool show coming up. One Great Work Warriors. The last week of the month is going to be talking shitcoms. We're going to talk some shit about shitcoms. So that'll be fun. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. I'm going to go ahead and play us out here with my post-show talk. All right. Have a good night, everyone. Thanks
Peace
much.
Peace, y'all. Appreciate you.
I think people form their worldviews oftentimes between the time of being like 8 or 9 years old to the time that you're in your early 20s for the most part. And I think from what I've observed, human beings I've known and met, most people have fairly well determined what they consider to be their worldview. By the time they're in their early 20s or so, and then maybe they might do some sort of review again somewhere between 30 and 40, but for the most part, they've just hardened from there on out, sticking more and more to the system of belief they've already created. So what am I talking about, system of belief? Well, when you're an infant, when you're a baby, everything's new. And as many of you have observed, little kids have an extra abundance of energy that for many of us seems amazing. Like energy that just keeps coming and coming. And this is part of the generative growth process of a human being. You're naturally just supplied with an extra level of energy in order for your body to grow and learn. What happens, though, is can you imagine, again, being an infant and taking in all this information from the beginning, like basic things like gravity, you know, when you open and close your eyes, when your hands touch things, like you're distinguishing all these things one from another, and you don't even have the concept that it's you that's distinguishing them yet. That takes time. That takes years of testing and being like, hey, every time I do something with my hand, something happens out there in the real world, and there's consequences to that. And I think that's part of why we have this opportunity to be in bodies and to go through that growing process of learning to be a human. But what happens is, as we get older, there's a lot of filters in our mind that are necessary for us to do more complex functions, like hunting, for instance. Hunting for food, or gathering food. You know, modern day, that's going to the grocery store and circumventing traffic, which all takes a lot of concentration, focus, energy. It doesn't leave a lot of that room for the infant, like, re-wondering about sensations and, you know, how far can my eyes see and what am I seeing and is it me seeing, you know, like all these like basic questions you only ever experience again if you do some hardcore drugs, like doing some heavy peyote or mushrooms or something like that. Your mind will go back to that infant state and you'll get to re-experience some of that, but it's overwhelming to most people and it can't really be done on a day-to-day basis because our mind is very focused and it's totally busy just keeping up with the day-to-day. So with the worldview, our belief structure becomes sort of like a map that we hold in the back of our mind, a template of sorts. If you can imagine your daily commute to work, most people have a daily commute to work. When it was your first day on your job, you might have had to use the application on your phone to help guide you there, or maybe you had to open a map and get to the right page and find exactly what highway you were on. But once you've done the drive enough times, you sort of have this template in your mind of the map. And unless you do some real odd turn that you've never done before, as long as you stay to the map to an extent, you don't need to rethink where to turn left and where to right. Your body just knows, and your mind can be totally like thinking about what you're going to do at work today and whether you've got to stop and get some coffee or take a crap or whatever. So that template, that map in your mind, is sort of like just becomes a default layer that you don't have to inspect and look at. Well, we have a map like that, a template, about how we see everything, reality itself, how we've decided what reality is. What are we doing here? What is this experience? You know, those questions that I would say are epistemology or philosophy that are the most important questions that we could or should be asking here in this existence, because if we haven't asked those questions and we get to the end of this experience and we realize we massively missed something that was hugely important, and now that could cost us, you know, some religions say if you don't do well in this life that you're going to experience torture for infinity, or you're not going to get to experience the wholeness of being with your maker. Instead, you're going to some demonic place with a hell, you know? You know, that's some pretty scary stuff, right? Personally, I don't think it's good to have that type of mentality on it, but I do think it's important to consider what that suggests, is that perhaps what you do on this life and the choices you make are extremely important and do affect whatever experience you have after this life or beyond this life. And it's easy to say, oh, I don't believe in that. I don't, I'm just going to discount that. And that's what a lot of people do. And that's a worldview. That's a belief system. You're making a clear choice on something you don't know. It may be that there's an afterlife, and it may be that there's not. Some people will say they conclusively know one way or the other. I think that's a belief system. That's a worldview, a reality, a way of interpreting and guessing what reality is. We have an intuition. Deep down, I feel fairly certain that there is something after this particular type of existence that will be different. And I think that what I did in this experience may well affect that. Why wouldn't it? It seems more likely to me that it would. So I'm going to work forward just because that's good logic, and it's also intuition. So it's a combination of left and right brain thinking. And I don't need to know, really. Like, if I live a really positive life and I feel good about who I am when I die, maybe it's worth it just for that. If there's nothing after that, just for that. Because as I was living a life full of purpose and moving like an arrow, through my life, there's a feeling of production, of getting something done, of working towards some purpose, and I meet other people on that path that have a similar drive, and we really hit it off, and we have these amazing relationships and conversations. So it's worth it in every way to live as if there's something coming up that's worth it, and that there's reason behind this life. But it can't be necessarily proved unilaterally, and we don't really know, even if it does say in some ancient book, even if our intuition does tell us, we still have to have a healthy bit of doubt. Otherwise, why would we have doubt, you know? And I think that's what kind of keeps us safe from getting too convicted on things we don't know. Things we say we know that we really don't know are lies. And a belief in a lie are very similar, and they start to bleed together. So you don't want to base your actions on a whole system of how you've interpreted and defined reality that is missing something really important. And you're going to go forward, live your whole life. To me, that's like going into a war and not bringing the bullets for your gun. Or going to cross a bridge and not knowing if the bridge actually goes to the other side of the gorge, you know. Or getting in on a boat out in the ocean and not knowing how to fix a boat, not having enough gas, or not bringing a life jacket or fire extinguisher. Like, it's dumb. It's dumb to live your life on preset conditions that you've decided that you know, or someone's told you that you don't really know. And the person that told you could be just telling you so that they kind of get a one-up in their life, because now they have an advantage. You're willing to do things for them or give them things or follow their orders because they've set up this sort of structure of belief in your mind that that's just what you should do. And you're doing it just because of like a monkey see, monkey do, everybody else is, but not really considering it deep down for yourself that, well, there's a strong possibility that other human beings, perhaps in this lifetime or over multiple generations, have worked out ways of manipulating and corrupting other human beings around them in a massive way. Just like we've developed all kinds of sciences and engineering practices. So why wouldn't people engineer the way we engineer bridges and the way we engineer roads and every other thing? Why wouldn't they engineer ways to manipulate people and to control their thoughts and to get them to do things for them? It's silly to think that people haven't done that, especially when there's so much evidence that people have done that. All through time, there's evidence of conspiratorial agendas and multi-generational conspiratorial agendas to corrupt, control, manipulate mass groups of people. So we know this to be true, and yet it's underestimated. And folks are so quick to take another pre-created belief system or a written down thing and just hold on to it so tight, like they know it's true, without properly having that level of doubt and skepticism that's necessary to even things out and to make a lifetime decision of what am I going to do with my time in my life? At what point am I going to stop and reanalyze that I could have been wasting a lot of time and energy in my life doing things that are actually unproductive and that are actually working against what the divine creator, the all's mind, really wants? Now, if you don't believe there's an all, and you don't believe in the hermetic principle concept of mentalism, you're very lost, right? And that's weird to say if you don't believe in that, right? Because I'm saying on the other hand, don't believe in things. And but on that, I think it's important to accept it as a very probable and likely truth, because there's so many ways to experience that. And that's like the only thing that in the world in reality that is on that nice edge of you should believe it to an extent, but don't believe it too much. You got to keep questioning it and wondering how it works and what it is. But are you questioning whether there is a such thing of reality? Whether you are living, whether you are alive, because that's what I'm talking about. That life, that spark of life that we are feeling, that there is a fucking certain truth that there is this mentalism, because there is this intelligence that we are experiencing that does not come from us. It was birthed when we were born. It was already there. We can see it already there in other people. That is recognizing something that's there. It's not believing something that could maybe be there and maybe not be there. Intelligence and creation and life itself, the spark of life, those things are self-evident. You don't need to question them very much. That's like the one thing that change, death, and life, you know, the reality of life, are things we really don't need to question and doubt of the way we do everything else. You know, so I understand why there's a lot of confusion there, because that is a mystery and that is confusing. Because on the one hand, we're saying, you know, like, don't believe, don't just take things on faith. But the whole idea of God and this great creator and divine all, there isn't a level of, wow, that's really hard to get my mind around. It's something bigger than I am. It seems somewhat impossible to me, or, you know, above possible, if that was a word. Ultra possible, it seems like I can't even quite imagine the whole thing. But I can imagine the intelligence that I have and the intelligence that other people have. And I can also recognize that that's something that comes from this whole, whatever this is, this whole reality. And this reality has something very unique that can produce intelligence. And that there indicates that intelligence is analogous, it's symmetrical, it's parallel, it's a part of everything. It exists before we do. We don't create the intelligence creates us. And Ellen Watts says, you know, like a fruit doesn't grow from a thorn, right? And so how does the intelligence that, and the heart and the love that's in each one of us come from nothing? That just doesn't make sense. Nothing comes from nothing. Things come from something. Things come from something else. And that there is a very solid truth, and that we can reflect on it and meditate on it and experience it and communicate it and corroborate it in so many ways. I would say it's a solid truth. It's not a belief. But it is on that knife's edge, like I'm saying, of things that are hard, a little harder than getting hit in the head with the rock or boiling water on your arm, to the communicate between us. And that's partly because the waters of that communication have been so muddied their time with people claiming to own religions, claiming to own a connection to God, claiming that a connection to God can only happen through certain people at certain times, using certain material world things like the bones of a holy ancestor or a holy relic, or it goes on and on. Because so many years religion, spirituality has been defined through religion and through authoritarian manipulative means, it leaves us in a spot where it's really hard to distinguish the truth behind our maker and the original love, the original truth, the original essence of freedom, life, reality itself, natural law, are all the same thing. It takes a lot of self-work and deep understanding to recognize and discover that truth. But it is recognizable and discoverable within each of us. That I feel certain of. But I can't tell you that you can know it as a truth just because I do. Because you won't know it as a truth until you take that time to discover it and realize it on your own. So it is a personal, subjective experience to reach towards the objective. And that's a whole nother conversation that we're going to have soon on the End Evil podcast about objective versus subjective. But I hope I sorted some things out and gave some more food for thought regarding worldviews and belief systems and my take on God and reality and its relationship to worldviews and belief systems and why they become almost instantly dangerous and corruptible and manipulative just because it can be done and it will be. And, okay, there's more to say on how to stop it and the solutions, but I'm going to leave that for the podcast and for guests who might have shown up. Thanks for coming.